Good evening and welcome to the Revolutionary Socialist Review with Chris Driscoll and Rainer Shea. How are you doing, Rainer?
I'm glad to be back at this. We've been having some real problems in these last couple of days that have delayed the latest show. We've had to abandon Skype.
Yeah. We're going with Zoom this tonight. We'll see how that works. Zoom has a few little drawbacks, but hopefully things will go great and we'll be fine. And let me reorient myself. Talking about all these technical problems, I've been nose deep in technical problems the last 3 days, trying to look at new video conferencing sites and figure things out. Let's just keep our fingers crossed and hope that the video gods are with us. This has been, week and a half or so since the last time we joined people. This has been a hell of a tumultuous ride. Former MP from Great Britain, George Galloway, whose show, the mother of all talk shows, I listen to and watch every weekend. He starts his shows off saying, "Watch out, because it's going to be a bumpy ride." And this last week was a bumpy ride for all included. But the first topic of our discussion tonight, we don't really have a name yet. We'll name it after we're through. But so the name is just Revolutionary Socialist Review, Wednesday, September 2, 2020. And the first topic of the night, really, I don't think you could avoid this topic, is after Portland and Kenosha shootings, Trump and Biden allies trade blame for clashes across the country. Now, both in Portland and in Kenosha, there were terrible shootings. In Kenosha, a young man, 25-year-old man, what's Jacob's last name? I'm drawing a blank here, but young man was shot 7 times in the back by the police. I'm sure most people have seen this by now. And in the aftermath of that, Kenosha blew up. No other way to describe it. People were angry and they were letting out their righteous anger. A lot of peaceful demonstrations, some property damage. Then people in Portland who have been protesting every day since the George Floyd murder by police, were responding to what was going on in Kenosha. And in Portland, on Saturday evening, there was a clash between Trump supporters, basically fascist terrorists, thugs, they looked like to me, who had earlier in the day held a pro-Trump rally in a neighboring town. And then they decided to take their rally into Portland and confront the anti-police state protesters. They were beating people and acting like, in general, like fascist thugs typically do. And one of them was shot. I think they were also shooting at people, but one of the fascist terrorists was shot, later turns out to death. This was quite astounding to me to see the video, because in the video, the man is is laying face down, and Antifa medic runs up and tries to give first aid to the injured man. But actually, I should tell first, before that, the man's friend runs up and turns his body over. Now, you're not supposed to turn a body over of anyone who's injured. You leave them alone until trained medical personnel arrives. But in this case, this, you know, I mean, these people don't have big brains. What can we say? This Trump terrorist runs up and turns his friend over. He's shouting at him, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" It's obvious he's not okay. Then the Antifa medic runs up, and she starts trying to give first aid, and the fascist's friend, the dead fascist's friend, he's shouting at her, "Get the hell out of here, you fucking cunt!" You know, he's shouting epithets at this poor woman who's just trying to help. And then one of her friends comes up, another Antifa guy, I guess, and says, "Hey, dude, she's just trying to help." You know, anyway. it just goes to show, I mean, even when a trained medic is trying to save this guy's life, the fascists will still try to push her away. That's the whole thing's extraordinary to me. So there's been tumult on both sides. As I said up top, the Biden and Trump campaigns are trading charges against each other. Trump saying that if Biden were president, this is the way America would be all the time. And it's quite incredible to me, to tell you the truth, quite incredible. What can we say? What can we say? The whole country has been riveted by this. People on both sides, people on the Trump side and people on the on our side, I guess you'd say. I think we should say. Protests are breaking out all over the country over this. So Rainer, what are your thoughts on this?
Now, I've been, this last week has been is inflamed some very important discussions within the communist community about arms and about violence, and how these tools should be used, how they can be used constructively. Because Thomas Sankara said that a soldier without the political and ideological training is a potential criminal. And I've seen lots of people on the online community say things like, "Buy a gun." And these are not disagreeable things to say. And the format makes it so that you kind of have to say things as short as possible. But we should also qualify these statements with discourse about how we can make our movement better able to handle this kind of power, the power of violence, and who we can trust to help gain this kind of power. I think that as our groups move towards getting more better armed and trained, we need to step up our security culture. As they say, we need to we need to read up on the pitfalls that can lead people to adventurism, which is to say engagements and actions that aren't really informed by the proper ideological perspective and that aren't really informed by theory. And we generally need to accompany the arms training and arms equipping with better education, because without education and without the precautions to stop potential traitors from gaining these weapons, then we'll have a higher potential for people in our movement to make serious mistakes. So I could say that one aspect of the reality that we're facing right now is arms aren't really useful for trying to gain power. They're pretty much just useful for trying to defend from fascists like Kyle Rittenhouse. This is the really scary thing, and this is what's driving people to get armed. There will be many more Kyle Rittenhouses in the coming months and years. I don't know about months, but years, I would say definitely. I'm making that prediction because the forces of capitalist reaction are escalating amid this deteriorating economic situation, and the polarization is the highest it's been in decades, and there's going to be more violence in the 2020s as this whole capitalist crisis continues. So our communist groups, we need to get better physically equipped and better ideologically equipped so that we're able to take the right actions to both protect ourselves in the short term and ultimately move towards the situation the kind of situation that's happening in Bolivia, where there's this massive guerrilla movement that's threatening to unseat the fascist regime.
Sorry. Right. Next on the topic list is in Washington, D.C. last Friday. 50,000 people turned out for a gigantic, what I would call it an anti-police state rally, but it was in commemoration of the big I Have a Dream rally, Martin Luther King, in 1963. And I don't know if you saw some of the pictures, Rainer, but I saw these side-by-side pictures of 1963 and 2020, and it looked exactly alike. I mean, in both cases, the whole what in DC, what we call the mall, the reflecting pool, I guess, in between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial. It's an amazing, like, big, wide, long, broad pool that stretches forever, and then. All along the side, gigantic crowds. Anyway, the estimate was 50,000 people were there. It was a very mixed crowd. I mean, you know, there were some white people, some, you know, like guilty liberals or whatever, some communists and socialists who were white in the 63 crowd. But I'd say that the number of people other than blacks, and of course blacks have always been and are today the vanguard in fighting against police brutality and fighting for your basic political rights, fighting for social justice, fighting for economic reforms or revolution. Black people, the black communities have always been in the leadership, in the vanguard. But people from other ethnic groups, other ethnicities, Europeans, Latin Americans, it was a very mixed crowd, and I was impressed by that. Also impressed by just the the slogans that were raised there, a lot of them anti-police brutality slogans, reminding people of our fallen, our dead in this struggle. It was, I think, an impressive thing. Back in the day when I used to live in the D.C. area, I would have been there. I mean, if I was still there, I would have been there. So I kind of miss it. It makes me kind of nostalgic in a way. But I was happy, very happy to see it happen.
So yeah, that's it. We've been seeing so many of these kinds of events happen in these last few months. And I think that as people whose priorities are proletarian and anti-colonial revolution, as people who hold up this this revolutionary line and want this continent to ultimately move towards a decolonized socialist former America, we need to take advantage of these kinds of demonstrations of anger at the system by reaching out to all of these people who agree with the baseline, which is that the system is unjust, and we need to unify this movement that's emerged since the murder of George Floyd. We need to unify it behind a revolutionary program, because what's happening now is not a revolution. It's a kind of popular reaction to all these contradictions within the system of colonialism and capitalism and imperialism. And until we can sufficiently create the support for an anti-colonial proletarian movement, then the danger is going to be that all this passion is going to be misdirected by opportunists like the Democrats. It's so disgusting how these Democrats are trying to use identity politics to rope people into their imperialist, colonialist, white supremacist, capitalist party.
Yeah.
To present an alternative.
And that's exactly what they're doing. That's what they've done every single time during every single big social movement that's ever erupted in the United States. That's why we always say, and we should keep saying, that the Democratic Party is the graveyard of social movements. If a social movement gets sucked into that, and we can see it, mentioning the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, soon after Martin Luther King was murdered, with the collusion of the FBI, this process started with all of the young guys who were Martin Luther King's closest allies, aides, advisors, all ended up going off into the Democrat Party and into Democrat Party politics. The Andrew Young is an example, or Jesse Jackson was there when Martin Luther King was murdered. Who's the congressman who just recently died and was buried? I can't remember his name. He's another one that was with Martin Luther King constantly. He was at one time the head of SNCC he was the head of SNCC for a while, but he went off to help out work with Martin Luther King. All these people ended up going into the Democrat Party and becoming Democrat Party politicians. So that was the end of the civil rights movement, basically. People now are trying to revive the Black Power movement. I think that's going to happen. I think that's already happening. That's a good thing. You know, you're right. We've got to watch out for those Democrats. People should be forewarned, and they should be armed with the knowledge of how Democrats operate and what they will do to subvert movements for social justice.
Yeah, well, I didn't know that some of the people who were close to MLK decided to kind of give up and join the Democratic Party. I mean, this wasn't their only option. They could have continued with that effort to create a revolutionary vanguard in orgs like the Black Panther Party. I mean, this shows we need to stay away from the temptation of joining with the Democratic Party, because the appeal of the Democratic Party is that it's accessible. It can give you a big platform. It can give you money if corruption is something you like. We need to stay away from this and work to build the modern equivalence of the Black Panther Party. I think that at least in terms of this election, the candidate that Marxists should vote for is Gloria LaRiva of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I think that LaRiva is superior to any other third party candidate, in that that she's committed to anti-imperialism. Apparently, a couple of years ago, LaRiva stated that the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, is a socialist country that the PSL supports. And I think this is a very good sign, because the Black Panther Party also supported the DPRK and helped form relationships with it.
Yeah, unmuted. Yeah, PSL, the Party of Socialism and Liberation, and of course the Workers World Party, from which the PSL split back. God, it was a long time ago now. I can't even remember the date, but back in the early part of the century, basically, I have always supported the North Korea, the Korean communists, and of course other socialist workers' states around the world. So that's good. Gloria LaRiva, you know, I wouldn't say anything bad against the woman. She's really got great politics. Of course, I don't believe in voting, so I'm not going to be voting for her. If you've got to vote, which is bad in itself because it supports an evil, corrupt, rigged, plutocratic system and government and state. If you've got to vote, yeah, vote for Gloria LaRiva. I'm with you there. As far as I go on it. Anyway, where are we at here? Let's see what's next. Trump again. We should have mentioned, talking about Kenosha and Portland, that Trump visited Kenosha on Tuesday, riled up a lot of people, got a lot of people angry. A lot of the protests on Tuesday were about Trump and opposed to Trump in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Trump on Monday announced that he's extending the moratorium on residential payments, residential evictions for another 4 months, that is till the end of the year, until January 1st. That really doesn't take care of a lot of the problem, of course, because people will still owe all the money that they owe so far, and they will owe all the money they owe for the next 4 months to their landlords. Of course, if you are a landlord, a person who has a house who rents out, or apartment complex or many apartment complex, if you're a slumlord, like the guy who owns the house I live in, you're still, you're going to have to go all this time not getting paid. You know, I mean, I kind of feel sorry for like a person who owns a single house and they rent it out. I have several friends who do that. That's not quite the same thing as being a slumlord or owning a apartment complexes all over town or all over the world or all over the country. But if you are a person who was being threatened, which billions were, with eviction, both people who are renters and people who have mortgages that they are behind in paying because of the COVID-19 crisis and because of the Greater Depression, which started before the COVID-19 crisis, we should always mention, then you have a respite for 4 months. That's good, but still isn't solving the problem. Now, Trump did, or his Mnuchin, his Secretary of, the Commerce Secretary, did say that Congress still needs to get together and come up with some solutions that are more permanent, that really help out people who are in dire need and really close to being kicked out of their homes. This Trump mandate is based on a 1944 public health law. It was announced by the CDC. That public health law allows the president to do all kinds of extraordinary emergency measures in a public health crisis. No, I don't think anyone would disagree that this is a public health crisis. So there are already Democrats mostly who are claiming that Trump does not have the authority to do this. Well, Congress itself passed that 1944 law, and the law gives the president this authority. So, he does have the authority. He's used it. Congress really needs to get its shit together and solve something more permanent in nature, and not just about the fucking COVID-19, because this isn't just about COVID-19. This is about the Greater Depression, which started before COVID-19, and which is going to continue going on long after people start getting vaccines. I mean, people are already getting vaccines in Russia and China, in the sane countries. People are already getting vaccines for this. So once the vaccines start spreading around the world, we'll probably be the last, if ever, to get the vaccine, because Trump has already basically banned the Russian vaccine from ever coming into America. So the Greater Depression is still going to be here after COVID becomes less of a problem. COVID is still going to probably be a problem for a long time to come, because there's still going to be all these idiots who refuse to take the vaccine when it becomes available. But at some point, hopefully, COVID won't be as big of a problem paralyzing the economy as it has been for the last 5-6 months. And hopefully things will get better. So there you have it. Brainer.
Yeah, well, let's see. What was got to talking about the moratorium and housing and then vaccines. So it's a lot to process.
Yeah.
Well, am I to understand that Trump is in the Trump's actions on the housing crisis involve some kind of austerity? Like is he deliberately engineering a situation where people are getting less resources than they would otherwise? Because he did this in July when he reduced he cut the weekly unemployment benefits in half, and this seems like another instance of COVID-19 austerity potentially.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going there. You'll have to explain more, but you know, basically, I think this is from Trump's point of view. I think Trump's aim is pretty obvious. The election's coming up, and he doesn't want 20, 30 million, 40 million people being evicted from their homes. Imagine 40 million people out on the streets, angry as hell, homeless, and Trump is running for re-election. No, he doesn't want that. And that's exactly what we're headed for. What he wants to do is forestall that until January 1st, until after he's sure that he has won the election, or, you know, sure about what's going on with the election anyway. I think that's his main goal. I'm not sure if there's any austerity about that. It doesn't really have anything to do with fiscal matters or credit matters, other than that you don't have to pay your rent for 4 months, but then you'll have to pay up after the 4 months. So you're not going to get evicted today, but you'll get evicted in January, essentially.
This was why I mentioned austerity, because there's the government's first priority, as we've seen, isn't to let everybody maintain their old standard of living. The main priority is helping the capitalist class keep business running, and we'll see what happens after January. We'll see how much of benefits the government will be willing to give.
Yeah.
At a certain point. Yeah. You're frozen.
Yeah, now you were frozen. Am I still frozen?
No.
Okay. So my internet connection is unstable. Oh, geez. The gods of the internet are screwing with us. They're probably fascists or Republicans or something. Anyway, Rainer, next on the list has to do with, let's see, only a dictatorship of the proletariat can defeat capitalism. I think this is apropos for what you were talking about earlier, having to do with these big social eruptions and giant protest demonstrations in Washington, D.C. and so forth. So tell us about it.
I'm looking at the situation in Bolivia, and what's happened this last month is that the indigenous movement has forced the coup government in Bolivia to hold an election on October 18th. So on that day, this will be a day of reckoning when we see whether the forces of Bolivian democracy and the Bolivian masses are able to defeat the coup government on the coup government's own turf, because Bolivia is a capitalist state. And in a capitalist state, the capitalist class has the upper hand, and this is why Morales was removed, because the capitalists and their reactionary agents, and the forces of U.S. imperialism were so easily able to stir up racist violence that forced Morales to step down, and that turned enough of the military against him. And this has been a pretty common occurrence when socialists have run in capitalist electoral systems. Coups are very easy to take to carry out, as we've seen with the U.S. regime change operations in Latin America throughout the last half century or so. Whereas in the cases of dictatorships of the proletariat, socialist worker states like the DPRK and Cuba and Vietnam and Laos and China, it's been a lot harder to undo the gains that the working class has made. In the case of the Soviet Union, I think that the reason why socialism was able to be dismantled in Russia is because the revisionists within the Soviet government really abandoned the dictatorship of the proletariat. After Stalin, Khrushchev, I think that's how you pronounce his name, he allowed capitalists to start having some power over the state. And he made too many concessions to the imperialists, and this eventually resulted in the traitor Gorbachev, who sold his country out to the forces of neoliberalism. So I think that this shows that the governmental model of countries like Cuba and the DPRK are the best defense against the forces of capitalist reaction. The dictatorship of the proletariat is the best way for socialists to gain and keep power.
Yeah, there. Have myself muted so I wouldn't make noises while you're speaking. But that's really a good point. I think that this is the crux of the matter. I mean, the central axis of division within the global socialist movement. The global socialist movement sets 1918, at least, really since the beginning of World War II and World War I in 1914, has been divided on exactly this subject. Can you make socialism? Can you make socialist changes while accommodating your class enemy, while collaborating with your class enemy? I don't think that it started with Khrushchev either. I think it started with Stalin in 1936, 1935, with the Popular Front strategy, which was a class collaborationist strategy. And, most observers, even people who were very close to Stalin, say that Stalin decided to go with this route because he felt like, and I understand Stalin's point of view, don't get me wrong here, I understand why he did this. He was concerned with saving the Soviet Union, and that's an important consideration. However, his solution, the Popular Front, that is collaborating with the political parties of our class enemies, of the ruling class, of the capitalist class, that was the beginning. And Stalin's goal there was to start being able to get some economic respite from the economic warfare that the entire imperialist world was constantly throwing at the Soviet Union. So, you know, that's in my opinion, that was the beginning of the slippery slope that ended with Gorbachev. You know, Khrushchev, upon Stalin's death in 1953, 1954, 1955, and in the crucial year of 1956, when the 20th Congress of the Soviet Communist Party took place, and the so-called secret speech by Khrushchev took place, a very central plank in Khrushchev's strategy, his foreign policy strategy, was peaceful coexistence. And later on, Mao adapted this same strategy when he started meeting with Henry Kissinger, and then in 1972 with Richard Nixon. Same approach. It's understandable why these countries that are under a tumult of being pummeled by economic warfare, and we know about this economic warfare, we see it every day against Venezuela, against Nicaragua, against Cuba, against Syria, and against Iraq and Iran, against Russia, and certainly right now against China. This economic warfare is terrible. You can understand why they want to avoid it. But on the other hand, the real solution to avoiding it is global socialist revolution, overthrowing the cause of all this violence, the cause of all this economic sabotage. So, but anyway, great, great article. I read it. I recommend others to read it. Go to rainershay.com and look it up. Maybe I should read the title of the article again. It was "Only a Dictatorship of the Proletariat Can Defend Capitalism." So, I'm sorry. Jeez. I'm getting old, Brainer. Blame it on my elderliness. Can defeat capitalism. Yeah, good catch there. Who is behind Joe Biden divisions in the ruling class? Now, this one it comes from an article it comes from a video by Caleb Maupin. Caleb, people who watch this show will know we had Caleb on. We've had Caleb on the show, I think, twice in the past. He's pretty well known, primarily because of his work that he does at RT, the RT TV network, All News, 24-Hour News Network. Anyway, this video has a short introduction by Patrice Greenville, who's the editor-in-chief and the publisher of the Greenville Post. And Patrice says, Biden warns Caleb Maupin represents a real and acute threat. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me read that again, because I read it with the wrong emphasis. Biden warns Caleb Maupin represents a real and acute threat to dissent, freedom of speech. Under Biden, the empire will redouble its efforts to clean the internet of anti-imperialist voices, probably via bans and outright criminalization of dissent, dissident speech, and actual jail sentences. what Trump offers is not much different or better, as both candidates represent only the two wings of the divided ruling class, whose interests and desires are 100% in conflict with the wishes and needs of the 99%. Their only differences are between strategies and priorities. In sum, both represent a specter of actual tyranny, something which is also being seen across the EU with similar cultural and ideological justifications. Foremost, the Biden wing wants to establish social peace, stability, government legitimacy, which they see eroded under Trump. These are the Rockefellers, the DuPonts, the Carnegies, the Morgans, etc. They are the managerial wing of the ruling class, those most recent servants of Obama, the Clintons, and of course, large sections of the deep state, as he calls the deep state intel agencies. This informal coalition is comprised of the ultra-rich families and clans. On the other hand, there's the Trump coalition, focused and sometimes obsessed with short-term profits. They are the entrepreneurial wing, the owners of firms like Home Depot, Blackwater, the Mercenary Army, etc. They are staging an uprising against the older wing, the long-term thinkers. This upstart wing calls the older wing, older ultra-rich wing, the globalists. That's what I call them too. Meanwhile, the globalists, whose most notorious organization is the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, aka the brains of the CIA, have one goal: survival and dominance of Western imperialism. Caleb's video can be found on the Greenville Post. Look it up there. He has a lot more to say on this subject. You know, of course, for years now, I have been talking on this show about the split in the ruling class in the United States and globally between the nationalists, as I call them, people who back Trump, and the globalists. I think they really cleanly and clearly are represented by Biden representing the globalists and Trump representing the nationalists. Although Trump has obviously caved into the globalists a lot over the last three and three quarters years. So anyway, there you have it.
You've correctly diagnosed the division, though we should clarify that that when we say the term globalist, we mean it purely in the as a descriptive political word, not in the context that fascist propagandists that like Alex Jones use it in, which is to say blame the Jews, they're globalists. But it does describe this divide of priorities. The Biden side is more focused on maintaining international relations, like better relations with its allies in the EU and in Canada, whereas the nationalists are focused on this more isolationist or protectionist standpoints, which is why Trump has been starting trade wars with allies and has been more uncompromising and belligerent towards allies. And I think we discussed this last week, the reason why some Venezuela regime change advocates, like the editor of the Miami Herald, see Biden as the superior candidate is because Biden would better maintain relations with allies, and they therefore they hope Venezuela is more likely to experience an imperialist regime change under Biden. So, but this is probably wishful thinking, because how much can an election really change about the dynamics of the direction of Latin American politics? And of course, if Biden wins, it won't reverse this huge process of shifting towards a multipolar world where Russia and China gain increasing power. So this is basically, in this increasingly unstable world, the Biden side of the ruling class views their paradigm as the better way to keep the empire stable and to keep the country stable and to maintain U.S. relations that can maintain American power better. Whereas Trump is much more quickly wrecking American power. He's exposing the empire for its ugliness, and Trump is making it harder for the empire to act pragmatically.
Exactly. Moving on to the next topic. TikTok. Everybody knows about TikTok. I had never heard of it a year ago, but we all know about it now. TikTok, a Chinese company. It's owned by a parent company in China. TikTok has come under attack, assault by the Trump regime. The Trump regime has told them they have like 30 days or something. You know, it's like one of those Old West things. You got 30 days to get out of town. You got a day to get out of town. They've got 30 days to sell that they're no longer going to be allowed to operate in the United States. Now, the Chinese government on Friday, very cleverly, very astutely, correctly, the Chinese Communist Party-led Chinese socialist government, they put out a bunch of new restrictions on exporting technologies. And some of these technologies are technologies that are crucial to TikTok. So a lot of the commentators, including people like Forbes and Bloomberg, are saying that China has effectively banned the sale of TikTok. Well, they haven't banned the sale. TikTok can still sell all of its American assets except for the technologies that are on this banned export list. And so these happen to be the exact same technologies that are the only reason that Google and Amazon and Microsoft are hungry and desperate to get a hold of TikTok. So effectively, China has just cut the legs out from under Microsoft, Google, and Amazon, because if one of those three gigantic multinational evil companies gets a hold of TikTok, they're not going to get a hold of the algorithms, the technologies that allow for the sharing of TikTok's members' videos. So, so there you go. This is some great news. I think people in China are cheering over this. Talked to my friend Steve on Saturday. Steve, who lives in Wuhan, China, for the last more than decade, and he says people in China are really ecstatic over this. They're really happy and really, you know, applauding the Communist Party of China for this brilliant and bold move. China's been doing some other stuff that's, you know, aimed at undercutting the Trump regime's war against China, their hybrid warfare against China. So things are moving along in, on that front. So your thoughts, Rainer?
Oh, well, this is good news because we've been talking about this move by Trump throughout this last month and to engage in piracy against against China and to try to steal the social media app to the fullest extent that the United States can steal it. But naturally, the Communist Party is able to make its own maneuvers, and it really seems like it's limited what Trump can do. We've talked about primitive accumulation and how the how U.S. imperialism has lately been trying to steal the resources of other countries in alternative to being able to seize their productive forces, which was easier when it was easier for the U.S. to subdue countries. But it looks like Trump has for the most part lost this TikTok battle, right? Muted, right?
Right. Had to unmute myself. In between when you're talking, I turn my fan on to cool off a little bit because I'm sitting outside and it's still 92 degrees. Not terrible for Phoenix, but it is still hot. Anyway, back to your question. What was your question again?
Well, it seems like Trump has, for the most part, lost this TikTok battle.
Well, I mean, he's still damaged TikTok because imagine, you know, TikTok, I'm sure, doesn't want to offload its entire American assets. That's a big chunk of TikTok. It's not, you know, going to kill TikTok, but it's a big chunk of it. It's not going to kill TikTok's parent company, which owns a lot of shit. But it is, a blow against them. It is economic warfare, and there's no doubt about that. They've minimized the damage quite a bit and also undercut these vulture companies that were going to swoop in and pick off the TikTok carcass. So that's good news. Anyway, let's see. We're getting close to the time we're going to be booted off here. So let me hurry on to the next topic quick, see if we can get it in there. The Chinese foreign minister made a trip to France. He proposed a four-point proposal to promote multilateralism. Now, this, in my opinion, is a very important meeting. The meeting was between the foreign ministers of China and France. France, of course, is one of the two major economies in the EU, in the European Union, and this is very important for continuing and advancing China's influence in the EU. China's making great inroads. I mean, we've talked already a couple of times in the recent weeks about Italy and Italy's improving relationship with China. Many of the Eastern European countries are also improving their relationship with China, and of course the Belt and Road Initiative will reach into the EU and will reach into parts of Europe, especially into Italy, because Italy will be a major port for products that are at the end of this new Silk Road coming from China and other parts east. So this was a pretty important meeting. It happened last week and I think into the weekend. And they made a lot of progress, really undercuts the American attempt to undercut China by promoting multilateralism and promoting a multipolar, not a unipolar world. The Americans want, when I say the Americans, I mean the American ruling class, the American government wants a unipolar world where they're in charge everywhere. But that's slowly sinking. And this was a major, I think, this meeting between the foreign ministers of France and China was a major step forward in promoting multilateral relations in the world.
Yes, this is the kind of thing that the United States is always going to be committed to pushing back against. We see how these European countries like Italy and Serbia have been embracing China more, and how Italy apparently joined the New Silk Road back in March in defiance of Italy's allies, which shows just how appealing China's offers are in this worldwide situation where the U.S. is shrinking as an economic power while China is rising. And we're seeing how China is growing its economic presence in Africa to the overwhelmingly positive neutral relationship that China is able to establish with these overexploited African countries. And the U.S. is always going to push back against this. The U.S. Will always refuse to acknowledge the very obvious merits of economically joining with China, because America's priority is to try to stay as the economic hegemon. And I can't imagine a scenario where the U.S. will end its economic war from China, where it will stop trying to economically isolate from China, because it's committed to maintaining imperialist control. And I think that in the long term, the consequences of this the strengthening Chinese economic ties, especially when it comes to ties with the third world, it's going to be a reversal of the process of Western colonialism. The great economic imbalance that's been caused by colonialism and neocolonialism is slowly being undone. The balance is starting to go away due to how China is helping these countries. And obviously that's not going to bring proletarian revolutions to these countries. China doesn't have the priority of trying to foment revolutions worldwide, but it will give the global proletariat within these global South countries more control, at least because they're going to be a lot more free from the grip of Western colonialism and imperialism, and so I think that basically, China's economic rise is making U.S. imperialism weaker, and this will have a lot of positive effects for obvious reasons.
Yes, I agree. Let's see, moving right along, we're rushed on time here. Topic 8, U.S. left aligns with State Department on Cold War against China. You can see we've got a lot of China talk here towards the end of the topic list. This comes from a video from the Gray Zone. People know we've talked about the Gray Zone in the past, and the video is from the show Red Lines, which is done by Anya Perimpel. She interviews Danny Haifong, who, of course, one of our favorites here on the Revolutionary Socialist Review. And in this Gray Zone, you can find this, just go to thegrayzone.com. The latest episode of Red Lines with Anya Perimpel. And she's interviewing Danny Haifong. Danny, of course, has been to China. I was real surprised to find out from my friend Steve that Danny is a friend of Steve's, that Danny met Steve when he was in China. My friend Steve, who lives in Wuhan. So Danny really gets around. Anyway, he's been on our show several times. We love him. This video was phenomenal, stupendous, hard-hitting. Anya Perimpel really asks great questions. Danny answers them all in a stupendous way. And Danny slams magazines like the the Social Democrat magazine that's so egregious. Jacobin, thank you. Danny slams Jacobin, the Jacobin magazine. He slams Democracy Now on Pacifica Radio Networks for taking the side of the State Department, taking the side of the Trump regime, taking the side of U.S. imperialism, of the American empire against China. And he says this is emblematic of the U.S. left in general, much of the U.S. left, or much of what they call the U.S. left, much of which is not left at all. I mean, they include progressives and liberals in that category, and yet most progressives and liberals are right wing. They're not left wing. How in hell can you call someone like Biden or the Clintons or Al Gore or John Kerry? How can you call those people left wing? How can you call Nancy Pelosi left wing? That's absurd. But in any case, Danny slams the left for taking the side of imperialism, using State Department talking points against China. Danny does a great job in this video. People should really check it out. Danny does a great job in this video of defending China, of explaining. And here's something that Anya does that's really great. She just says, okay, I'm going to hit you with a bunch of typical questions that we get hit with constantly from these left people, these American left, these Western leftists, in their criticisms of China. And she just tossed these questions at Danny, and Danny really answered each one, you know. What about the Uyghurs in northwestern China and the way the Chinese government is imprisoning them and, you know, millions of them in prisons and, you know, and Danny just answered all these idiotic questions, these, you know, State Department talking points, each one after another. So I really recommend people go to the Gray Zone. .com. Check out Red Lines with Anya Perimpel interviewing Danny Haifong. Okay, let's move on to the next. For some reason, Zoom is allowing us to stay. I don't know why, but let's go with it. Next, U.S. imperialists continue to conceal their war against Syria.
Yes, yes. In this article, I observe how right from the start, the aim of the regime change mongers in Syria, ever since they activated their armed and trained jihadist groups in Syria in 2011, they've tried to portray it not as a U.S. regime change war, but as a legitimate uprising against a government that they portray as totally evil, and they've used this to get a lot of the Western left, as we just mentioned, on their side, like able to sympathize with the YPG and sometimes join the YPG, even though the YPG has been aligned with NATO. And right now, the YPG is facilitating the illegal U.S. exploitation of Syria's oil in northeastern Syria. And we've seen trends like this ever since the U.S. war on Syria got going 9 years ago, as the strains of the media and the commentariat who call themselves left have aligned with the narrative that the white helmets are a legitimate humanitarian organization, even though there's all this evidence that the White Helmets have facilitated U.S. propaganda and have ties to the U.S.-backed terrorists. And there's also the moderate rebels narrative that have tried to portray the terrorists in Syria as working for a legitimate cause, even though they've really just been stirring up incomprehensible amount of violence. Millions of refugees from Syria and hundreds of thousands dead in Syria because of this jihadist war that the U.S. kicked off. And this is how the U.S. imperialist propagandists have been able to conceal their operations, because they obviously haven't wanted another perception like that's emerged around their war on Vietnam or Iraq. When people think of the U.S. wars against Vietnam or Iraq, they pretty much always view the U.S. as the villain in the situation, whereas when it comes to Syria, due to these deceptive tactics that the Syria narrative managers have used, a common perception is still that the uprising against Assad has been totally legitimate, and that the U.S. imperialism isn't even a relevant factor. And still we see these Western leftists defend the YPG, even though the YPG is directly facilitating the illegal CIA exploitation of Syria's oil. So this is how the smoke screen has been pulled over the eyes of a lot of people in the West who many of whom call themselves anti-imperialist. And this has, of course, also gone along with the smearing of journalists like Vanessa Bealey, who tried to expose U.S. imperialist operations in Syria, and also the censorship of many people who've tried to expose these realities. I don't think I've told you the story of my experience with Syrian war propaganda censorship. I was censored last July. I had my old Medium account removed apparently because, as Medium had said, my White Helmets article caused reputational harm to the White Helmets. The Medium doesn't remove people's accounts for criticizing the Democratic Party, but when it comes to the White Helmets, exceptions are made. And it's no wonder, because it's very important for the imperialists to manage the narrative when it comes to Syria. And they're continuing to do this as the U.S. imposes these brutal sanctions on Syria that are crippling Syria's economy and painting the sanctions as some kind of legitimate act of justice against Assad for his supposed crimes, and as the U.S. illegally exploits Syria's oil.
Yes, exactly. I've spoken about this quite a lot on the show over the last 3-4 years at least. So I'm not going to add a whole lot other than saying I agree 100%. There are some really, those same publications or video shows that I mentioned, like Democracy Now, for example. Democracy Now is a really extreme case. Counterpunch.org, another extreme case. And of taking the side of American imperialism, taking the side of the terrorists in Syria, against the legitimate, legally elected, popularly elected government of Bashar al-Assad. It's just incredible to me. Anyway, last on our list tonight, wow. Actually, I eliminated several of the original topics I had on here just so we could get through this faster. But U.S. sanctions, Russian research institute that developed COVID-19 vaccine. Now, this to me is really an egregious, it goes beyond the pale, because this is denying human beings of an essential health product that can save lives, that is already saving lives. So basically, by putting sanctions on the laboratory, which is I should point out, it's a publicly owned laboratory. President Putin decided early on that he wasn't going to give private enterprises in Russia the opportunity to come in and price gouge and make huge profits off of this. So he was going to have it developed by a publicly owned laboratory, and this publicly owned laboratory, which is affiliated with the Russian army, developed this stupendous vaccine, which is the first one out. It's already proven to be safe and successful. It's right now in international trials in 20 different countries among thousands of people are trialing it and trying it out. Vladimir Putin's own daughter was one of the first volunteers to get this vaccine. She's still alive and kicking with no COVID-19. She's immune to COVID-19 now because she has the antibodies in her body. And so are all these other people who've gotten this stupendous vaccine. So why would the U.S. government and the U.S. capitalist ruling class, why would they sanction this company that created, a publicly owned company, that created this tremendous vaccine, this stupendous life-saving vaccine? Well, go figure. I have no clue. But it's certainly, I've talked to a lot of people on Facebook about this, and people are riled up about it, as they should be. Millions, probably billions of people were waiting, are waiting for a vaccine. So for the U.S. to deliberately try to interfere with the production, with the creation of this vaccine, interfere with getting this vaccine out, it's just beyond my imagination. And it is a crime against humanity, in my opinion.
Are they trying to use some sort of narrative to justify this? As are they just keeping quiet about it? Because
there's a narrative. I mean, the Trump regime has had loads of things to say about this vaccine. They're telling people around the world, trying to tell people around the world, this vaccine is unsafe. You shouldn't use it. It hasn't gone through all the typical trials that a vaccine goes through. Well, you know, the typical trials take 10 years. We don't have 10 fucking years to wait for a vaccine. That's ridiculous. And believe me, the American effort, they're not going to wait 10 years. I'll guarantee you that. They're going to cut corners on the trials. Hopefully they do the same amount of trials that the Russian government and the Russian company have done to make sure that it's safe. But nobody wants to wait 10 years for a vaccine for COVID-19. That would be ridiculous. Millions and millions and millions of people will die of this dangerous virus in that period of time. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, this seems like the best way that they could try to justify what they're doing, because a lot of people are sympathetic to trying to be cautious of new vaccines like this. And it does sound like this is an unusual situation where the Russian government really have no choice but to push this immediately, because the situation is so urgent. And unfortunately, we don't know what any unintended consequences of this this vaccine will be. I guess my take on it is that this is the best justification that they could try to use.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. It's the best justification that they could possibly use. Well, Rainer, we made it to the end. It's 9:21 now, so we've been going about an hour and 20 minutes. Good job. Kudos on you. Anything else you want to raise or mention before we sign off?
No, I like this new format. Send me the link. I'll try to download it and put it on my YouTube channel.
We'll try to get it out. We'll try to people should know, we should tell people that this will be going up on YouTube, both on my account, YouTube account, and on Rainer's YouTube account. We'll try to spread it. We'll share the link widely, and hopefully this will work better than our old service, Blog Talk Radio, which we felt was not really getting the reach that we could get through other platforms. So with that, I'd like to thank everybody for listening. Thank all of our listeners out there, our loyal listeners, especially who've been with us for years. Of course, thank you, Rainer Shea, for all the hard work you put into this show, and bid everyone adieu until next week. Hopefully all these technical problems we've been dealing with will be all solved, and we'll get back to our Monday schedule. We'll produce something on Monday evening and post it immediately afterwards. So with that, signing off. So long, Rainer. Goodbye, viewers.